May it please the court, I'm Mark Elliott, number 16845, and I'm appearing on behalf of the panel McTaggart-Kearns, the claimant below in the workers' compensation case. What I'm asking the court to do today, and in connection with the briefings that we filed, is to apply common sense to the undisputed facts in this case. And I think if you do that, you have to find that there was a compensable injury in this case. Have to find. Number two, I think you have to find under long established Supreme Court precedent, and that's the Merriman case, that the respondents were responsible at an absolute minimum to pay for the medical treatment that the claimant received on the day of the accident, March 7th, 2013, in Atlanta, Georgia, when she was on a trip. Overall, there's another argument that I'll present about the entire case being tainted by the ALJ's misreading of some fundamental facts in the case. And because of that, I think we're entitled to a remand for a new hearing before a completely different ALJ who hasn't got those preconceived notions already in her mind.
What authority do we have to require that it be assigned to a new ALJ?
Well, there's not specific authority, but based on the argument here, Judge, that the ALJ has made some fundamental mistakes of fact and was tainted, we believe, by the inadmissible and improper expert testimony of Dr. Roth, that fundamental fairness requires that the case should be heard by a different judge. Now, that's my third argument today, and I'm happy to address that now if you want to talk about it, but there's no specific authority. It's based on the idea of fundamental fairness and in light of the factual findings I'll talk about in more detail in my other arguments that the ALJ simply got wrong.
Well, let's address that. What are the facts that the ALJ got wrong?
Well, we'll start with the single most important fact, and a fact that the ICAO agrees that she got wrong, and that is, if you take a look at the ALJ's ruling, and specifically we're talking about its paragraph 11 of the findings of fact. This is record at 988, so the page 988 of the record. The ALJ found, as a matter of fact, the ER staff discharged the claimant with a diagnosis of musculoskeletal chest pain, that's correct, and released her to return to work without restrictions. That is incorrect, as a matter of fact. And if you look at the record, the actual records that are relied upon to make that determination, if you look at page 43 of the record, the Atlanta Medical Center records say work release form 2 days or 2 day. Page 51 of the same record, there is a reference to the employee being unable to work for 2 days from the day of the injury, 3/7 of 2013. Then it talks about no restrictions after that 2 days, but by then she had already been back to Denver, seen her own personal doctor as she was instructed to do, and was taken off for 2 more weeks.
But Mr. Elliott, I'm speaking of that ER report that you just talked about.
Correct.
As you pointed out, it says she can return to work within she can return to work 2 days from the date of the injury, and then the employee has the following restrictions, no restrictions. Couldn't we read the ALJ's decision as simply reflecting the fact that when she got back to work, she would have no restrictions?
I don't think you can, number one, because that's not what the order said. If you look at paragraph 11, it says exactly what I said it says. But what you're saying, Judge, is exactly what ICAO said. They said, well, it says she's off for 2 days, but after that, she has no restrictions. Well, then we have to look, again, we have to go back to the facts of this case and apply common sense. She's traveling for work. There's no dispute she's on travel status. Respondents concede she's on travel status. She's down in Atlanta for a 4 to 5 day job. And she lands in Atlanta, Georgia on That morning, she rents a car, and she's driving to her hotel to begin her assignment the next day or sometime on that day, and gets rear-ended in a car accident on that day. Okay? When she's released from the ER that day, and this is in the claimant's exhibits, but if you look at the record at 29, the record at 31, and the record at 36, there's some important things that happen. She tells them all of the things that we tried to show at hearing. I had a CT scan of my brain, but they didn't see a bleed. They released me, said I couldn't drive or work until at least Sunday.
Where did they say that she couldn't drive?
Because she had hit.
No, where did they say that? I didn't see that in the records.
Well, I didn't see it either, but it's in these employment records, which are admitted in workers' compensation case, are evidence in the case. She says that. And then they say to her, well, she says, I'm supposed to follow up with my doctor in Denver. I'm going to be on a plane the next morning. And the response she gets from her two supervisors, Dennis Brudeau, at record of 29, and Rebecca Bowling, record of 31, is, don't worry about anything. Take care of yourself. It's, please go take care of yourself and let me know if there's anything we can do for you. There's no attempt to say, no, you need to stay there and work after you're released in 2 days. There's nothing except go back to Denver. So she goes back to Denver. As soon as she goes back to Denver, she's seen by her family doctor on Saturday the 9th, the day that the ER doctor, after that day, she'd been released by the ER doctor's notes. Her family doctor takes her off for 2 more weeks. But even without reference to that, as soon as she leaves Texas, she's not going to complete the 4 or 5 day assignment that she had had been given, and the whole reason why she was sent down there to travel. Now, you ask about other findings by the judge.
So was the ALJ required to credit the claimant's personal doctor's decision to take her off for 2 weeks as being having a causal relation to the accident? Was the ALJ required to do that?
In isolation, the ALJ is not required to do that. My argument is that if you look at everything as a whole and include the context of the case, yes. But in this in any particular case, the answer is no. It would be unfair for me to say to you that she had to credit that. There's certainly reasons in the record why she should have done that, but my argument is more about the total, the record in total, looking at the mistakes the ALJ made. And let me point out another one that I think is very significant. As you guys probably know, the way it works in workers' comp, in most cases, we submit proposed findings to the judge, and the judge then issues one side or the other with modifications or whatever. And that's what happened here. But if you look at the record on page 987, the ALJ entered a finding that was made, that was put in there by respondent's counsel. And it says, the vehicle in front of claimants only had slight rear end damage, and the claimant's vehicle had moderate rear end damage. And based on the actual record, which is on page 36 of the record, accident report, what you find when you look at that is that has really nothing to do with the issue in the case.
But why is that? I thought you were saying this was a factual error.
But it's a factual misstatement or a cherry pick that I think shows that the judge didn't look at everything in context. Because what the record actually shows, all right, is that the car that hit Ms. McTaggart Kearns had extensive front end damage after a 13-foot skid, and that Ms. McTaggart Kearns' car had moderate damage to the back of her car. Those are the facts that matter in this case. Not that she was then pushed. It does matter that she was pushed so hard that she actually did use slight damage, but the key fact is the extensive damage to the front end of the other vehicle.
So you're not saying that the ALJ made a misstatement. You're saying she failed to say something else that you thought was important.
Right. So she makes a fundamental misstatement about no restrictions, not restricted from work. That's wrong. This is fundamentally wrong. And this is just another example of the ALJ making a statement that misses the point of what we're arguing.
Mr. Elliott, you don't have to do it now, but before you're done, can you address your argument that the doctor, is it a Rath or Roth, was prejudiced, did not have an open mind?
I will. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time. I see you have 4:30 left. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time, but I will address that.
No. I don't want you to sit down before you address
it. Oh, you want me to address it now?
Right.
Okay. I guess I'm not quite sure that I understand your question, because my argument is not that he had a closed mind, although what I think you're referring to, Judge, is the reference in both his report and Dr. Myers complaining about his report that says before he even interviews her, he said, you don't have anything new.
Right.
And that, for me, turns on the issue of our challenging, well, we challenged his expertise. I'm not going to go over that again. We challenged, more importantly, I think, the methodology he used to reach his diagnosis of somatoform disorder. And that's where it's very important, because what we're talking about was that before he even interviewed, and he's supposed to conduct a 2 or 3 hour interview under the methodology testimony that's been presented in the case. He's supposed to submit psychometric testing. He did none of that. He's supposed to apply the DSM-IV. He did none of that. And in fact, by just reviewing her records, he had already decided before he even interviewed her that she had somatoform disorder and she had no new injuries because of this, because that's the only explanation that you could come up with to say that she had no new injuries from this significant car accident. And if I can, I'm going to reserve the remaining 2:53 of my time.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, Karen Trees, registration number 11610, appearing on behalf of Dell and insurance company of the state of Pennsylvania. I apologize in advance. I will be surprised if I can get through this without coughing. But importantly, the most significant aspect of this case is no injury was found by the ALJ. She determined that the claimant failed to meet her burden of proof by preponderance of the evidence that she had sustained an injury in the course and scope of her employment. Well, it's true that the employer did not dispute that there was an accident. The City of Boulder versus Payne case decided by the Supreme Court indicated that there is an important distinction to be drawn between an accident and an injury. And an accident, they're not interchangeable. An accident is the cause. Injury is physical trauma caused by the accident. The ALJ did not see that, did not believe that claimant had sustained an injury.
Ms. Trees, is there any basis in the record to support a finding that the claimant had the ER treatment and diagnostic testing that she had for any reason other than that motor vehicle accident?
Yes, in this sense. Claimant has had two prior car accidents where she was hit from behind. In both of those situations, the accident description was almost identical. In both of these situations, she sought emergency room treatment. In February, less than a month before this industrial action, she hit her head on an airplane luggage bin, required stitches. When she went to the emergency room, she chose to go to the emergency room on her own, unlike the situation in the Sims case, which claimant wants to rely upon to determine that claimant sought Sims for the proposition that respondents are liable for emergency and authorized treatment reasonable and necessary to cure or relieve the effects of the industrial injury.
But didn't your own doctor acknowledge that because the claimant was on Coumadin, that it was appropriate for her to go to the emergency room and have the diagnostic testing?
Yes, but does it have to be an injury that arises out of the comp system? And the court found that there was no injury. Let's talk about Merriman for a couple seconds here, because in Merriman, it's similar because the claimant went to the emergency room on the day of her injury, but it's different, or the day of her accident. It's different because the employer acquiesced in having the claimant go to the emergency room. And in that case, the emergency room doctor took the claimant off work for 3 days. And then the treating physician took the claimant off for 2.5 months. Despite that, the Court of Appeals agreed with the finding that claimant had not overcome the opinion of the administrative law judge that claimant had sustained a compensable injury or incapacity to be entitled to TTD. Remand in that case was only for the purpose of determining whether the emergency room treatment expenses should be compensable. This case did not stand for the proposition, as claimant argued in the brief, that emergency room treatment, employer is supposed to pay for emergency room treatment. It didn't say that. It had a remand, and then we don't know what happened after the remand. But I can tell you one thing. The Comp Act is clear on what it is that you pay for. And you pay for cure and relief medical treatment to cure the person of their industrial injuries. There was no industrial injury.
Counsel, excuse me. Are you saying that there was never any... The Act does not provide for payment for medical expenses related to diagnostics to figure out whether there's an injury?
In the context of a compensable case, yes, but not in the context of a case where there's no injury. There's an important distinction. And you cannot read provisions into the Comp Act that don't exist.
I'm sorry, you keep saying Comp Act. What do you mean?
Work Comp Act.
Comp Act.
It's
okay,
my
sorry.
Congestion.
No, it's my fault. Go ahead. Continue.
So what do you claim the holding of Merriman is?
Well, in Merriman, they upheld the judge's finding that there was no compensable injury. They remanded for the determination of whether or not the emergency room treatment should have been paid for. However, they did not need to do that because they had already determined there was no compensable injury. So when there's no injury, the employer cannot be held responsible for any treatment. There's another case that's really important on this point. This not reading any provisions into the Act that don't exist, there's support for that in Krauss versus Art Kraft Sign, when the claimant tried to argue that the employer tried to argue that the claimant was fraudulent because they didn't disclose a prior injury. The court said, well, that was on his application for employment, not in the context of trying to get his comp benefits. You can't read that in. And Winter versus ICAO, the court held the reimbursement of medical expenses provision says reimbursement. It doesn't say advancement. We can't read any provisions into the rules that don't exist.
Well, I understand the basis of your argument is there's no injury. So why is it not significant that the ER doctor took her off work for 2 days?
It doesn't matter, because the claimant is putting the cart before the horse on this thing. You have to have a compensable injury before you can have disability. Claimant cites a number of cases for the proposition that when you miss 3 days, it's a compensable injury. He's taking that out of context. What that statute is that says that is 843.301, and it established the conditions of recovery. And the pertinent question is, was the injury or death proximately caused by an injury or occupational disease arising out of the course and scope of claimant's injury? The ALJ said there was no injury. Claimant argues that missing 3 shifts as a matter of law equals compensable injury. That's not the case. 842.103 provides that disability indemnity payable as wages if the injury or occupational disease causes the disability. You can't do it in reverse. You can't say because there was lost time, there's a compensable injury. He's citing cases that are in the context of statute of limitations cases, whether it be as to reopening time periods or whether it be as to reporting of injury cases, where the claimant returned to work. So there wasn't 3 days of lost time. Statute of limitations would normally run, but it doesn't run from the accident. It runs from the date of the disability. So those statute of limitations cases do not define just because you have lost time. Your lost time could be due to the flu. Just because you have lost time doesn't equal a compensable work comp injury. The first, you have to have the traumatic injury, which the ALJ did not find. She did not believe the woman struck her head on the steering wheel. She did not. The emergency room didn't see any marks. The claimant on her own, as distinguished from the Merriman case, or as distinguished from the Sims case, the claimant on her own went to the ER. She chose voluntarily to undertake that risk that she didn't have an injury. But interestingly enough, when she had struck her head on the airplane bin, she had stitches. They told her to get a CAT scan for her head to rule out brain bleed. She didn't think that was necessary to do it then. That was in February. She didn't get a CAT scan to rule out brain bleed until they had the car accident that the judge didn't believe she struck her head on.
Ms. Treese, I just want to make sure I understand your argument. You're saying that the mere fact that when an accident occurs, and it occurred, you concede during the course and scope of employment, right?
Right.
You concede that.
Right.
So you have an accident, a motor vehicle accident that occurs during the course and scope, and as a result of that accident, and only that accident, the claimant has to get at least diagnostic testing done to determine if they were injured. You're saying that if an ALJ later determines that there wasn't a causal relationship between the accident and any injury, that even those diagnostic tests are not covered by the Workers' Comp Act?
That's correct, because you can't read non-existent provisions into the Act. And that diagnostic test, in fact, found there was no injury. Also, we are not entitled to reweigh the judge's credibility determinations, what testimony she thought was persuasive or not. He is asking you to do is to reweigh that evidence. And the ALJ was in the best position to determine these credibility determinations and whether to agree that some of this testimony is persuasive and some of it is not. The ALJ did not find it persuasive that the claimant had reported to her doctor when no diagnostic tests supported it, no anatomic findings, no x-rays, nothing supported a new injury. The ALJ was free to disregard claimant's statement that she felt her pain might have been a different intensity or in a different location when she had a significant lifelong history of certain conditions that she's trying to claim that are now related to this, and was treating the day before her injury and in the 3 months before her injury for the exact same conditions for things such as neck ache, back ache, anxiety, word finding difficulties, headaches, blurry visions, all of those symptoms claimant had been treating for in the 3 months before her accident and for several years predating her accident.
All right, let me ask you this question then, because I think claimant is arguing that the ALJ's finding of no injury was based on the flawed premise that the ER doctor did not take her off work for 2 days, implying, I think, that they thought there was an injury causing that recommendation that she be off work for 2 days. Is there anything in the record explaining why the ER doc said 2 days off?
There is not, and there's nothing in the medical record saying anything about taking her off from driving. The work release is ambiguous on record page 51. It does say she may return to work in 2 days, no restrictions. It's ambiguous. It's a resolution of the fact by the ALJ. But it doesn't matter. In this Sims case, the ER doc took him off for 3 days and he was off for 2.5 months, and the court found, we agree, there's no compensable injury. As long as there's substantial evidence in the record, this court must accept the findings of the ALJ. The ALJ did the heavy lifting here. This is a simple case in terms of was there then substantial evidence contained in the record?
Counsel, before you leave the ER doctor's work release form, what exactly is the ambiguity in it that you're identifying?
It doesn't impose any specific restrictions on her. Normally, what you would see is cannot lift 5 pounds.
Sorry, isn't it clear from the report that the doctor thinks she cannot work at all for the next 2 days? Isn't that a restriction?
I don't read it that way, and I don't think you have to read it that way. I don't think the judge read it that way. But it doesn't matter whether it's a restriction or not. It doesn't support that she sustained an injury in the course and scope of her employment. The ALJ made 76 findings to support her position that claimant wasn't injured. And that is a significant number of findings, weighing of the evidence. Let me briefly get to Dr. Ross' testimony. First of all, Dr. Ross has extensive experience testifying as an expert in pain complaints as they relate to emotion or behavioral findings. He's level 2 accredited, which includes psychiatric diagnosis rating. He was fully qualified. Rule 702 is a very broad scope of if scientific or other specialized knowledge will assist the trier of fact, as long as the expert has knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education. And he doesn't, by case law, have to have a particular degree or award or certificate. He was qualified to testify. They make a big deal about the fact that he said that he had some somatoform disorder. The record reflects many, many complaints supportive of the diagnosis of somatoform disorder. His unendorsed rebuttal expert was able to cross-examine or refute the opinions of Dr. Roth. His treating physician, Dr. Ruswick, was able to refute the opinions of Dr. Roth. And he had extensively cross-examined Dr. Roth. Those are the types of protections that are appropriate in determining whether there was an abuse of discretion in letting him testify. And the judge did not rely on the diagnosis of somatoform disorder in determining that there was no compensable injury. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll try to address points in order. Let's see. Ms. McTaggart-Kearns was working full travel duty with Dell at the time of this injury and had been doing that for months previous to this. We don't dispute that she had pre-existing conditions and she never denied them, but she's working full duty, travel duty, no restrictions when she goes to Atlanta that day. She has a car accident. She doesn't show up at an ER sua sponte. She has a car accident, a significant car accident, and gets treatment for that. With respect to your comment, Judge, about the no work for 2 days, is it a restriction? Absolutely, it's a restriction, and that's, ICAO read it that way. That's the only way they thought they could support what the ALJ did. So they said, we don't read it as being her seeing no restrictions, that she was released that day.
Can I return to your comment that there was a significant injury revealed when she went to the ER after the accident? And was there any objective evidence that she suffered injury as a result of the accident?
Well, I think what I said was there was an extensive car accident, but in any event.
But isn't it your position there was injury, significant injury?
Oh, absolutely.
So what was the objective evidence of that injury?
She leaves the ER that day with a specific diagnosis of musculoskeletal chest pain with a restriction of 2 days of no work. She has other complaints and they check out her neck. But you have to remember, she comes, the EMT personnel and ambulance arrive at the scene. This is a record of 54. She's in a cervical collar and placed on a backboard. She's brought to a level 1 trauma center. That's the record at 29 and 31. So they're looking at, they bring her to a level 1 trauma center.
But these are based on her subjective, these are based on her subjective report of her symptoms. This is not objective evidence.
Well, probably, but we're talking about a situation where before that she's fine, and then she has this car accident, and we're talking about a car accident with extensive damage to the front end of the other car and moderate damage to the other car, and we have a doctor saying, yes, there's something going on here. There's a diagnosis. There's 2 days off work. Follow up with your doctor. Every doctor since then after that, that she sees supports a diagnosis of injury. The only doctor who doesn't is Dr. Roth.
Mr. Elliott, what is your understanding of the holding of Merriman?
I'm glad you raised that, Judge, because this is really important. If you look at the record on page 849, the second hearing in this case, I asked Dr. Roth a question that you mentioned earlier, Judge Berger, and it was about whether or not is it reasonable for somebody who's in this situation to go on Coumadin. And if you look at Ms. Treese's answer from line 5 to line 14 of that, I don't have time to go on any further, it says exactly what I'm saying here. It is the holding of Merriman. And they acknowledge that they're responsible for that treatment under the case law without reference to injury. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for your excellent arguments. And the case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. And that does end our docket for this afternoon. So the bailiff may announce a recess.